I want to thank you and Robert for joining us all here today. I've done countless Zoom calls and Skypes over the past, what I think is now 2 months, 3 months, I forget, but really looking forward to this one. And as you said, a little bit of lightheartedness. And I really thank the Rob Report for helping us put this together. Can't say enough about Car of the Year. I know some of our guests have been there. It is a unique experience. And if you've gone so far as to get on this call, you need to think about crossing your fingers as much as we are that the world resumes a little bit to normalcy so that in November we might be able to hang out in Napa or Boca, I believe is where it's going. So I'd also like to let everyone know that we're making an audio recording of this conversation for perhaps a podcast use. And as David said, the chat function is a great way to connect with us. I don't know if we're going to be able to see everybody during the call or not, but the chat function is a great way to connect. And it's also a great way to think about something that Robert and I have been kicking around now and forever is the Dream Garage. So if anyone wants to try the chat function during this, I'm going to go ahead and try this now and see if this works. I don't know if everyone can see that. So I've limited myself to the first three cars that came to mind that I would put in the Dream Garage. The 300 SL Gullwing 1955, 67 Ferrari 330 GTC, and the Porsche 918 Spyder, judge as you will. And that's an interesting kind of precursor because some of those cars are a little bit older, and obviously one of them, as Tom said, is much newer. So if anyone cares to, you can send those along. I know Tom Mantione has a pretty interesting list that he might share with us along the way. So without further ado, there's a lot that I want to cover with Robert in terms of the current and future state of high-performance cars, automotive technology, the auction market, millennial collectors, any one of those topics we could easily talk about for hours and hours. So we're going to
try. And they very well could.
And so we're going to try and do our best. So, Robert, I thought we'd start by asking what the high-performance market looks like today, and what does that really even mean?
Well, thanks for that great introduction. And first of all, cheers to everyone from Los Angeles. It's a little too early to start drinking, but I hope you are all enjoying yourself. So thanks for joining.
Indeed.
You know, today's high-performance market is different than it would have been construed even 10 years ago. Certainly 20 or 30 or for a guy my age, you know, I remember when cars still had wooden wheels. The performance car market now is narrowing. It has gotten to a point where originally, you know, performance parameters were measured by a very simple yardstick. What's the horsepower? From that, you can probably predict horsepower and displacement. How fast does it go 0 to 60? What's the quarter mile time? These were the fairly primitive measuring tools that we used to use. Well, what's happened over the last, certainly, decade is that these performance numbers have collapsed. They've become more and more similar. They've certainly gotten lower in terms of time. They've got higher in terms of speed, and they've got outlandish in terms of horsepower and torque. So I think we're at a point now where cars, in many ways, we're talking about sports and luxury cars of a certain nature, are more similar in performance than they've ever been before. So it calls for a kind of different measuring tool to really assess their true nature.
Given your experience in all of these, what are those parameters we should be thinking about if it's not just 0 to 60 and a quarter mile?
Certainly racing has established the worth of a car back from the beginning. You know, when the first London to Brighton run happened in 1903 or whatever, it established the speed and reliability of a car. And of course, racing does the same thing. We've all seen the, you know, Ford versus Ferrari movie, and that was all about the, you know, speed and performance. Racing has always been able to shake out the winners. But for what we would call series production cars that we actually drive on the road, manufacturers have more recently taken to use, for instance, a standard measuring tool, which would be the Nürburgring Nordschleife. So now it's a matter of how quickly does the car go through this particular torturous circuit. And what it allows us to do is evaluate more than just power. It allows us to evaluate other technological advances of a car that may make it, in fact, give it some advantage, whether that's the chassis dynamics, suspension, aerodynamic efficiencies, certainly braking and tire technology. So all those things come together in a torture test like the Nordschleife to give manufacturers, at least for a brief moment, the possibility to be king of the hill. But it's funny, you look at how quickly these the crown is passed. The 918 was wickedly, blisteringly fast, but it wasn't long before the Lamborghini Performante, a car that cost a third as much, bested it. Now, granted, only by a few fractions of a second, which brings to mind what really matters in a car. Do these fractions of a second matter to us?
They matter to some of the people on this call, I know, but but that's a great point in terms of what really matters. You know, where are the trends? Where are the things that matter that manufacturers are focusing on?
Well, certainly everybody's trying to claim supremacy, but we have more shared technology than we've ever had before. It's not like some manufacturer has a secret 100-mile-per-gallon carburetor that nobody else has. So as technology becomes more ubiquitous, I think you'll see, again, more similarities between performance machines than dissimilarities. And in fact, the distinctions would then start to be made by way of the design, the signature, as it were. Although the wind tunnel can dictate a lot of things that might have been before the era of truly engineered, computer-engineered aerodynamics, I think designers had an opportunity to express themselves in some very eloquent ways that we wouldn't see today because they'd simply be proscribed by the computer. Mm. You can't do that. It won't go as fast as if you do something else.
Yeah, right. I do notice you have something very aerodynamic behind you and then something just small and with a tremendous power to weight ratio, I'm sure. We'll come back to that a little bit and come back to the technology a little bit later because of some very specific questions that I have in that space. So in terms of design and in terms of fun and in terms of all the things we love these machines for, what are you excited about coming to market either now or in the next year? Give us a sneak peek of what might be in the car of the year unofficially.
Unofficially, I think we're seeing evolutionary changes, evolution. So for instance, a car like the Lamborghini Evo, a Huracan Evo, would be a representation of how, an example of how there might not be what we would call groundbreaking changes in one model to the next, but we would see evolutionary changes that, for instance, the Porsche 911 series expresses so brilliantly. But eventually model refreshes are in order. So again, just picking on Lamborghini for a moment, models like the Aventador and the Huracan are going to soon be replaced by a new series of automobiles. But we can be sure that those will build on their predecessors. Porsche, on the other hand, has, you know, kept the 911 alive since 1964. And of course, it's virtually unrecognizable now when compared against it as a 911 when compared to the original. But I think certain principles philosophically and otherwise have been preserved. And that's what makes a car like a 911 so magical.
We've had a discussion about 911s that I'm going to ask you a second question in just a second. But one thing that I'm incredibly interested in, when you talk about evolution, is Chevy moving that power plant from the front of the car to the middle of the car and something that has captured my imagination. So what are your thoughts on the new VAT?
Well, first of all, Zora Arkastantov is spinning in his pine box right now because it's been virtually inconceivable. Well, actually, you know, I take that all back because he had proposed a mid-engine VAT back in the Stone Age of Corvette history.
And just to jump in right there, I was in Newport, Rhode Island in the summer. And there's a small automotive museum that Don Osborne, the classic car guy, kind of runs.
That's
And they had a grouping of the cars of the future there. And the 53 VET that they used for testing was there. And there was a whole, they had the mid-engine, they had it there. If I knew how to put a picture up, I would. It's on my phone. But they had the mid-engine prototype there, which is pretty incredible. But I'm sorry, keep going.
No, I remember it on the cover of Road and Track as a young guy. Corvette's always been a real barometer for what is possible in the world of the accessible. You know, they've always made the cars that go like hell and are affordable, relatively speaking. And I think certainly this new C8 series VET is the biggest leap of technology and performance that they've ever been able to make. I haven't liked Corvettes a lot. I like the old ones especially, just because I think the C2 was such a brilliant design. But the C8 series promises to really make everyone question why a car that cost five times more, whether a car that costs five times more is really five times better. And maybe that sort of gets to the heart of some of our future discussions today.
I absolutely think that's true. And then before we go, just because we were talking about Porsche and the evolution, and I know we've got, I can see there's been some Dream Garage information coming up there, and we've got a lot of 911 Turbo S fans on the call, myself included. I've found that to be pretty perfect right out of the box, albeit slightly higher than even what that C8 is going to cost. Where do you rank that? Is that the best out-of-the-box sports car you can get your hands on?
Well, you know, the true confession, I mean, I've always been a Porsche lover. I learned to drive on a 912 that my dad bought, and I bought my first 911, a new one, in 1990. So I've sort of been a, you know, I put my money where my mouth is for many, many years. The Turbo might be the best bang for the buck when measured against any other car. And considering the pedigree and the quality of manufacture and the thoughtfulness that Porsche engineers put into things, it's blisteringly fast. My personal flavor is something a little more vanilla. I like the GT3 behind me because that is a more essential car. It's not as complicated. It's not as blisteringly quick, but it does other things that I think are appealing in a puristic sort of way. But that's dancing around your question. I think if push comes to shove and somebody said, well, you know, just pick one and you can use it as a daily driver and you can get a case of wine in the back seat and you can pick up your dry cleaning, it would be hard to beat a Turbo S, especially the new one. And here's a shameless plug for the next issue of Rob Report. Stay tuned because our Best of the Best issue will have some things to share.
It's a great comment that you made with sort of the case of wine, right? Some of these cars are beautiful, amazing, but practical might not be the best description, right? You're not going to necessarily take the Lamborghini Aventador out to go pick your kids up at school or, you know, that thing's like a jet aircraft and it's purpose built. So we've talked a little bit about this in the past. It's kind of two questions. I mean, sort of the turbofication of many, many vehicles. But also, as you said, as that performance gap is narrowing, right, it's also bleeding across different categories, right? I don't know that they make many sedans anymore, much to my chagrin, or even worse, I grew up driving
station wagon. There's nothing better than a wagon.
I grew up driving my mom's Chevy Caprice station wagon. I think it was an 80-something, and it was probably as long as a Tahoe, at least, if not a Suburban. As you bled across, and performance is available in SUVs and sports cars and the few station wagons that are left. I'm thinking, you know, a Mercedes AMG or something like that. How does that kind of change how we think about this stuff?
Well, it's absolutely changed the landscape, which has been altered because people also want to sit up high and have some sense of command over the road. So the SUV has become the new sedan. And like you, I lament the demise of the traditional four-door and even more so the station wagon. I mean, for me, if I had the space and the wherewithal and needed to drive a lot, Mercedes AMG wagon would be my daily driver. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some advantages there. These cars are incredible performers. And you look at the SUV options these days, and I just had the Porsche Cayenne Turbo Coupe, for instance, to test for Rob Report, and it's a brilliant car. I mean, it's remarkable. It's not a 911, but short of its appearance and its footprint, it's every bit as capable on paper. And I think that as these performance narrows, and as you say, engines have become smaller in displacement, they're all forced induction now because they have to meet emissions and fuel efficiency standards. There's going to be a sameness, especially as manufacturers share power plants. You know, you've got a Bentley V8, it's essentially an Audi V8. And cars are more the same now than they ever were, just for the sake of economies of scale and because of engineering necessity. And by virtue of that, the SUV has sort of become the new performance machine. I think two years ago, Lamborghini Urus was our car of the year. Mm-hmm. Which says a lot about the capability of some of these things, which may ultimately then mean that we have to boil it down to aesthetics and less tangible factors. In other words, you know, what's really important in a sports car? A quote from 40-year-old Virgin, it's about connection. It's about the connection that you really feel with a car. And that connection may be visceral. Certainly, you punch the accelerator and you hear these great intake noise, the exhaust, but the connection might also be aesthetic. It might be historical. Maybe it means more to you that a car mark has been around for 100 years than a mark that's brand new. Maybe all of these things really have a subjective impact that really allows people to become fixated and fascinated with a certain kind of car.
Yeah, I think that visceral reaction and that connection is probably important to everybody on the call, except Greg Merrill, who doesn't own a car. So we're going to let him go. We're going to come back and talk about Greg specifically because he's a millennial and doesn't own a car. And that's a question that we have. Something popped in my head, kind of related to some of the other things we were talking about. But when you look at something like the Lamborghini Urusa and think about that power plant being moved around in the sphere of all those brands, do I just wait and wait for Audi to build a really torqued up version of the, I can't remember which one corresponds directly, but they look awfully similar, the Audi version and the Lamborghini version. And at some point, there's probably an RS that costs $100,000 less.
It probably does. But again, you go back to, and if seat of the pants performance is all that matters, then one can certainly do well by a BMW X5 M competition, or a larger one would be something like the Big Brute, would be something like the Audi SQ8. In comparison to the Bentley Bentayga. But what's been remarkable, though, is that even though there are shared drivetrains, every one of these marks seems to be pretty good about maintaining their own, overused word, DNA. So that if you drive a Lamborghini, it really does, there's something Italian about it. There's something about that car. And by the way, its Italianness is different than the Ferrari's Italianness.
Yeah,
and of course you go north of the Alps, and I mean the Germans are a whole different breed. Or you go to England, and as David Arnold will tell you, they're all crazy because they drive on the wrong side of the road. But those cars have a completely different.
Wait. First of all, it's the correct side of the road. I think we were driving before you were.
Well, the good news is there's something for everybody. What I love is the fact that despite shared drivetrains and technologies, there still is a personality inherent, we hope, in every single mark.
I would definitely agree. I know I think it was the last car of the year that I was at, there was the Audi RS8, perhaps, and one of the Lamborghinis. They were very similar in size and looked comparable, but the Lamborghini was cursing at me in Italian the entire time that I was driving it, and the Audi was just doing its job, right, in a very Teutonic fashion. We do have a question, which is a great question. John has asked about, what about a stick, traditional manual versus paddles? And I think it's pretty hard to find a traditional stick shift these days, right?
Well, regrettably, the stick shift has gone the way of the dodo bird, and it's at the hands of the emissions regulations. It's just impossible to make cars sufficiently efficient in terms of their fuel burn that will allow them to produce manual transmissions in mass. This Porsche behind me and, of course, the BMW are both manual transmissions, and that's because I only drive I have a BMW that's got a sequential box, but because that's all it comes with. But given my druthers, I would always buy a manual. And there, it really is a philosophical, underpinned by the belief that a stick shift makes you a better driver. It's also more fun to me. Now, it may not be fun on the 405 freeway at 5 p.m., but fundamentally, a stick shift is a great driving experience. That being said, nobody makes them anymore to speak of. And there's also no question that the performance of an automated manual or even a full automatic gearbox is just better. I mean, nobody, your Porsche RS2 is faster by virtue of the fact that it has that gearbox than a manual transmission. Of course, no manual transmission could handle the power either. So for those who love manuals, we have to look in the rearview mirror more or less and consider cars that are older and probably not too many new ones. Although to their credit, Porsche still offers a 911 with the manual, though not the Turbo S, as you know.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is you can't check your Twitter or your Instagram if you're driving a manual transmission, right?
That's right. It really does. It makes you think a little more, not take things as for granted. And that kind of engagement is what I really relish.
So I want to talk about some historical stuff, and I do want to talk about 100 things, but I also want to leave some time for questions. So
sure.
I know there's a lot of questions about kind of the future. So first part I'd like to talk about is electrification and hybridization. And we've had the conversation before, and the 918 spider is a great example, right? We've talked about it several times today, and that brings me back to the Porsche 959 from the 80s. And I feel like when that car came out, it kind of put a flag in the ground for this is what, you know, a high performance supercar is going to be. And it drove that for a long time. And when I drove the 918 Spider with, you know, that high performance mid-mounted engine and then those electric motors in there, it was a little bit like, wow, this is incredible. Not so much in saying that this is an electric vehicle and it's going to save the environment, but from a performance standpoint, what it was able to do was pretty amazing. And now we see, we were talking earlier, I don't know if everyone could hear us before the show started, we were talking about the Ferrari. So my question is, where do you see that stuff going? And is a hybrid future the way to go, or is a electric future the way to go?
Well, if I had that crystal ball, I'd probably be a lot better off than I am now, and I'd have all the cars I wanted. That being said, I have to remark on your acknowledging the 959 Porsche from the late 80s as really the look at the future. It was the first supercar, if you want to really, really plant that stake in the ground. It did things that no car before it had done, not only in terms of performance, but in terms of its drive platforms, all-wheel drive, all kinds of wonderful things. But then you fast forward to 2014 or whatever the year was for the 918, and it broached some new ideas. Now, I remember the first time I took one out, it sounded like pushing a lawnmower out of a shed because, you know, all I could hear were the brake rotors and the suspension clunking. And it's like, what's going on here? This is the most unsatisfying aural experience I've had in a long time. Of course, then you fire it up and the internal combustion engine kicks in and it becomes hell unleashed. For me, the satisfaction of hearing gasoline lit on fire under pressure is pretty exhilarating. And I know your electric car is quicker, but again, that gets back to how do we really evaluate performance. As far as where the technology is going to take us, I suspect that for the foreseeable future, there's going to be room for all of this. And there's going to have to be. I mean, you look at things like just strictly the infrastructure of dealing with electric cars in environments. So, I mean, imagine trying to actually get electrification in Berlin. I mean, it's at present almost unthinkable without some very grandiose social programs. So I think electric cars will have a place, but I think they'll have a place only in certain places. Hybridization is different. I mean, that affords some opportunities to, again, meet increasingly stringent emissions and requirements, but do it in a way that allows for greater flexibility. And of course, cars like the 918 and the LaFerrari and the McLaren P1 were really the beginning of that exploration. Obviously, the trickle-down theory would avail itself as manufacturers embrace all of these sort of hybridizations in their affordable road models.
So we've gotten another question from Steve talking about the Porsche Taycan. Have you gotten your hands on one of those yet?
Well, regrettably, I seem to be the last guy on the block. No, I have not driven one. Actually, had an opportunity, but this last few months has been has made it questionable as to whether or not I wanted to be on the street until recently. Some of my colleagues have. It promises to be everything that a Porsche has up its sleeve, and I think Porsche is a real no compromise organization, and my suspicion is that it will, again, set some bars. Is it going to make a Panamera irrelevant? I don't think so, but certainly it's going to have them competing with themselves for the foreseeable future.
Someone had actually separately texted me a question, which has a little bit more, I think, we're very Porsche-centric today, and I apologize.
It doesn't make you bad people. No.
It doesn't make you bad people, and I apologize. But it's an interesting question. You know, there's the BMW behind you is a great example as well. There's been a tremendous amount of sort of range of stratification, and, you know, I don't know the numbers, but I think Porsche these days is selling more SUVs than they're selling 911s.
Far and away.
They're probably selling far and away more Macans than they're selling anything else. They can be had fairly inexpensively coming off a lease, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And David and Tom, I promise that we won't talk too much. We're gonna try and keep it. But what happens when these
too late?
What happens when these sort of storied marks go down lower to broaden the appeal, perhaps? But is this a, you know, sort of a Ralph Lauren experience where we can sell to the masses, but we can also sell to the high end?
Well, it's more or less inevitable that if a manufacturer is going to stay in business, unless they're producing a handful of cars a year, like a, you know, a Morgan or some, you know, some outlier of that nature, they're going to have to take advantage of economies of scale. If it weren't for the Porsche Cayenne, I remember getting a VCR tape in the mail. I had just bought a new 911. I think it was a 993. And I got a VCR tape in the mail a couple of years later from Porsche trying to sell me one of these Cayennes. I'm like, yeah, you're mine. I threw it in the trash. Well, who's laughing now? It was the only way they could stay in business. You look at Lamborghini, for instance, and they very strategically decided that the way to stay in business, to grow, to be profitable, remain profitable, is to introduce the Urus. But that, in fact, it also allows them to maintain some exclusivity with their sports cars. So, for instance, between Aventadors and Urus, they'll only make 4,000 cars a year. They're never going to, at least so they say, they're never going to up that number. And what they'll do is produce concomitantly 4,000 Urus and maybe 5,000, maybe 6,000. They can produce as many of those as they like because those are, dare I say, a commodity. But an Aventador or its equivalent 5 years from now is going to be something more special. So it allows companies to stay in business. You talk about down market. If you look at a, you know, the strategy of brilliantly positioned by Mercedes years ago, the C-Class was a way of getting people addicted to the Mercedes crack, if you will, early on. And it's a way for, you know, younger customers to kind of get brought into the fold, and then you hope they'll never leave. My first car was a BMW. I bought it when I was 15 years old. It cost me $1,200. And I've never not had a BMW. So guess what? The crack worked. I'm addicted. I'll never not have one. I think they're great cars. If I bought a Mercedes back then, well, maybe I'd be a Mercedes guy.
We're going to get Greg to buy it, Greg Merrill to buy a Mercedes. I've driven that, what is it, the little C63 AMG, and it's absolutely a monster.
Fantastic. I love that car.
So in, your mind, you don't think it degrades the value of the brand?
I think it does not. It's inevitable that brands be more diverse and be recognized for these things. Ferrari's going to come out with an SUV. Rolls-Royce has an SUV. McLaren may be the last man standing, but even then, never say never. So I don't have any intel on that. But virtually everyone is joining the ranks because people want them. People seem to want them.
So I want to finish up on the modern stuff, and then I want to spend a little bit of time on a couple of other things. But we could literally talk for like another 6 hours. I've often said, and there's people on this call have probably heard me said it, that I feel like at some point in the future, combustion engine automobiles will be like horses are today, right? People will own them.
Yeah.
People will use them, but they're not taking them. I'm going to lay it out there and then, you know, maybe see where you go with it. But how do you think about automation? And what do you think about the concept that my car ownership may become a subscription, right? I may have a Mercedes subscription. And if I want a convertible on a Friday, I get a convertible. And if I need a GLS 550 to go to the wherever, I get that. So those are two different concepts. But what do you think about autonomous driving first? I hate the concept, but go ahead.
Well, I think a lot of people hate the concept. They don't trust it. Certainly autonomy, when it becomes a mainstream reality, we're going to see it with things like trucks. So certainly all the freight that travels, you know, on the roads across America and Europe and wherever, that'll be automated, and it will probably be a blessing. Although those are some of the better drivers we have, I'd like to automate some of the guys that go past me at 95 miles an hour on the freeway, cutting in and out of traffic. That's where automation would be a rich blessing. But I think that autonomy is certainly not around the corner. We're kidding ourselves if we think it is. As what happens to those internal combustion dinosaurs, you know, whether they're relegated to the track and the exploits of an old age home, it's entirely possible as technology makes their use more and more difficult or problematic, or vis-a-vis legislation, they get pushed out to pasture. I don't think I'll live long enough to see that. You raise an interesting point about the ride sharing and whatnot. There are the old sayings that if it flies or floats, you should probably rent it. And the same might be said about certain cars. And I would have almost defended that premise until 2 months ago. I don't know about you, but I don't want to get into somebody into a Rolls Royce that some stranger had just occupied an hour before. So I think that, you know, it may well be that our worldview has been changed, at least for the short-term foreseeable future, in terms of the subscriptions and ride shares and all that kind of thing. But in principle, it does have its interest. Although, truth be told, if I had a Porsche subscription, only time I'd borrow a McCann would be if I had to go haul fertilizer from the nursery. I'd be driving a 911. Not that there's anything wrong with a McCann. It's a brilliant little car.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, as they say. I tend to agree. When I think about my kids and they're driving, my daughter is 15 and she is chomping at the bit to get behind the wheel of an automobile, which is fantastic. That may have something to do that with
her dad?
The fact that her father drives cars like he stole them generally. Yeah. So in a very safe way, you know, you mentioned something about someone passing you at 95 miles an hour on the highway, weaving in and out of traffic. I'm going to guess that person's never had any training or actually been on a racetrack. And
yeah,
it's, you know, it's
probably not. Yeah.
Probably a big difference. So one kind of question about not necessarily valuation, because I want to stay away from that purposefully, but you know, you and I had a chance to have a chat about a friend of mine who's picking up a 2017 F12 Berlinetta from Ferrari. He's trying to debate what he swaps out or whether he just hides it from his wife and parks it in his warehouse.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Wouldn't be the first time you hide the Ferrari in the garage. What do you think, you could be specific or you could be general, what's something that someone could buy, not necessarily, you know, right off the rack, but 2 or 3 years of age on it, the right kind of miles in kind of one of these high performance ranges that you could drive for a few years and then unload and not necessarily be hurt too bad, too snake bit?
Well, I mean, there's no free lunch, and certainly some cars depreciate more vehemently than others. So McLarens are typically not as stable in their resale values as a car like a Ferrari. But this is just because of the historical preference for these things. It doesn't mean they're less good cars by any stretch. I think that if someone were willing to, and by the way, used cars are the smart person's way of acquiring a contemporary exotic, because after 2 years, you know, somebody else takes the hit, so to speak. I think that if you want to have a sure bet, you have to go back a little further and you make sure that it has a stick shift. So if you buy a Gallardo, Bel Lamborghini Gallardo 6-speed, I'd posit that you could even buy a Murcielago if you're crazy enough to want to drive one. Ferrari 599, any of the 430s with a 6-speed. 360 is a great car now, and I think probably the prettiest Ferrari of recent manufacture.
I would agree.
So I think it's possible to maybe look even a little further back in history, because these are still modern cars, so you're not giving up much. You're not going to have bragging rights that, you know, for the quickest Nordschleife of time, but you're going to have just as much fun when you start driving it. So a 6-speed is always going to be a trump card that you can throw down, and rest assured that you'll be able to probably get very close to where you started. More recent cars, again, just look for AMGs tend to go the way of the dodo bird in terms of residuals. They wouldn't like to hear me say that, but they do, because they're plentiful. And certainly Bentleys, you know, have been known to take a hit too.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask one more question, because I know I want to open it. We've tried to address some of these, and there are a few questions that are open. So I want to ask one more question that'll then go to, you know, sort of general questions. But we've talked a lot about the auction market, right? And my question to you is sort of what's going on in the auction market in general, particularly in terms of U.S. muscle cars, and also particularly in terms of every morning at 8:14 a.m. Eastern time, I get that email from bringatrailer.com and I open that sucker up. I ignore Tom Mantione's emails, not David Arnold's, but I ignore Tom's emails to open that bringatrailer.com to see what's on there. And even through all of the turmoil that we've had, they're still closing 50, 60 auctions a day nationally and selling these cars. So How do you feel about those topics?
Well, there's no question that people are still buying cars. The market that's taken a severe hit in the recent pandemic has been the seven-figure market. And obviously, it's tough to sell a $2 million, $4 million car, not that I've had the opportunity to try. But cars that are not quite so rarefied have done pretty well. It doesn't mean the values of those super high value cars are down. It just means that people are not willing to make those kinds of selling or buying decisions now. The auctions are, of course, experiencing a great deal of pain because they're not able to do things live, but I suspect that'll open up soon. They have been having some success with remote auctions. And as you mentioned, bring a trailer has really sort of changed the game because it's allowed people to have much more direct and daily access with more what I would call accessible cars. So I think it's a great business model and everyone essentially benefits. And yes, I agree, it's totally addictive. Totally addictive.
And again, just circling back in general, I know we've got a lot of people that own one or more in terms of like real solid blue chip American muscle cars. Where do you see,
muscle cars? Yeah. Muscle cars are tough. I follow them closely. I sold a Shelby GT350 a year ago. A 65, which is a very desirable car. And I had not wanted to sell it, but I got the so-called offer I couldn't refuse. And the guy that bought it from me was closer to 80 than 70. And I did my due diligence and realized that the auctions and the market did not support that kind of very generous and optimistic offer. The only reason I'm using this as an example is because I saw that an entire generation of people who would covet these cars and had the resources to acquire them might not be here 5 or 10 years from now. Muscle cars fall potentially into that segment because they are cars that are older. They don't have the universal cachet of something like your 67 330 GTC Ferrari. And it's more of an acquired taste. They're always going to be great cars. The C2 Corvettes are always going to be great. Kimi Cudas are always going to be great. I mean, the Boss 429 Mustangs are always going to be desirable. But across the board, I would say you buy one of those cars or restore one of those cars because you love them, not because that's where you're going to put your kids' college tuition fund.
Excellent. Well, I don't know if we need to do something specific to open up for questions. I will say I have another question from John asking, rather, what are your thoughts about reimagined cars like Singer versus continuation cars like Cobra?
Well, we need another hour for that.
I'm good.
I think the whole notion of continuation cars, in fact, I just wrote something on a Super Performance Cobra that'll go online, Rob Online, next week. They have their place. They allow people who could not afford or acquire one of the originals simply because there are too few of them or they cost too much to experience essentially the same thing. So continuation cars or whatnot are fantastic. I've had a conversation with the guys at Aston Martin talking about their Goldfinger continuation and their DB4 Zagato continuation cars. I mean, these are $4 million cars, so they're not chump change. And they're remarkable things. Are they ever going to be the original? No, but they're something else. Singer has created a very interesting market, as has Gunther Wirtz and a number of other people, because they're actually playing on they're taking a market that's very robust for old 911s, and they're parlaying that into a new business model. Whether or not those cars are going to maintain the value that they seem to have now, 10 years from now, remains to be seen. Personally, I would never have an interest in a car like that because I would want an old 911 and I'd want a new 911. But then I'm not a resto mod guy either. Although the market for, which is really what it is, it's a resto mod.
Sure.
You know, but there are always guys that are going to want to put a brand new crate motor in a 55 Chevy and put some air conditioning and power steering on it and some big Wilwood brakes. And they've got a modern hot rod that looks like an old car. So there's something for everybody.
I think reality television has fed into that quite a bit in terms of the resto-mod kind of market, which is pretty interesting. And all of the folks that I know that talk about Singers and lust after Singers tend to be Silicon Valley entrepreneurs for some particular reason. I don't know why that is necessarily. So if anyone has a question, again, there's a Q&A button as well as a webinar chat button. Or I don't know, David, if you were going to open this up for audio questions.
we can use the chat. I mean, if anybody wants to come off of mute or if anybody wants to open the video, you know, they can individually. We don't want to kind of open it up because some people in those funny slippers and, you know, don't want to expose anyone's foibles. We've already exposed yours, Andrew, and that was more than enough for me. So,
I won't stand up, I'll tell you.
But you and Robert,
I couldn't help
start a blog or something.
I certainly couldn't help but be interested in the stick shift conversation, because when you were saying that they don't make them anymore, I distinctly remember it was 4 or 5 years ago landing in Trapani on the island of Sicily and getting in a Mercedes-Benz Vito, which probably doesn't jump into the conversation that much, but that's a 9-person Mercedes passenger van. It was supposed to be automatic and it was a stick shift. And driving around old towns of Erice in that car with 70 plus my mother and mother-in-law, not feeling the stick shift at that moment, much like the 405 at 5 p.m.
That's right. That's right.
Lou has a question.
Yes, I'm sure he does. Lou, can we unmute? I don't know if anyone's noticed, but Lou has popped up as Vet Man. So, Robert, we may have to talk.
Well, there we go.
Lou, can you hear us?
Good man.
I can hear you very well. Thank you. Very interesting conversation. I don't own any foreign cars. I do have a small collection of domestic muscle cars. One of my questions is, and I asked it, I don't know if it was asked directly, and if you can't hear me, please tell me.
No, you can hear loud and clear.
The question about the value, when I look at the value of Porsche with putting out SUVs and four-door sedans, I mean, I understand what they have to do. I do think it's really having at least a value effect on what I think to be a Porsche. And I'm not a Porsche driver. I have driven them. And so goes the same quote-unquote point of view I have on electric. But I do know that it is something of the future. And if you don't have an electric car, or if you don't make a brand in an SUV or in a four-door sedan, eventually you won't be able to compete. So asking the question, if you think that's a viable, not viable, I mean, everybody's going to have an electric Corvette looking at electric now.
That's right.
I'm an electric 2021 or 2022 for sure.
Yeah, I think it's probably inevitable that all manufacturers, I mean, they're trying to, you know, they'll be electrifying or hybridizing the 911 if they can figure out how to cram all those lithium batteries in the floorboards. So I think it's inevitable that, and by the way, the cars will be better performers by virtue of it, at least in terms of their speed. But, you know, Corvette has an interesting place in history, because even though it's the car line within the Chevrolet mark, which is a mark within the GM brand, they've been able to remain separate. Corvette's got this mystery around them. They've got an aura of purpose. They've got a purpose, and they've never really diluted their image, because they haven't had to. It's always been a standalone, almost as if it were a different brand. I mean, really, when you say Corvette, people don't say Chevrolet. They say Corvette, and that's a very enviable place to be. They did it right starting back in 1953.
Thank you.
Porsche did it right in 1963, but with the 911, but that's all they had back then.
Thank you, Lou. Robert, we did have another question come up, which is from Bob, which is so funny because, Bob, the fourth car on my list that didn't make the cut was the BMW 507. So the question is, are there any available at a reasonable price? And I guess that's always going to be a relative question.
Right. What's reasonable? I mean, certainly they were reasonable 15 years ago, but then so was everything. 507 is an interesting car. It's quite lovely. I do not know of any for sale at present, but I'm happy to be in touch if I encounter some, you know, and that's a 7-figure car at present. I've driven them. I've driven a few of them. Personally, they're not as rewarding to drive as they are to look at, and as they represent a very significant and piece of BMW history, albeit a footnote in that history. I mean, it's a V8 engine, and it was a car that had essentially no progeny other than, you know, the Z8 sort of
right.
Records, purchasing it when it came out. It is certainly an A-grade collectible and a worthwhile addition to any collection.
Yes, I remember seeing one at Pebble Beach a long time ago, and it was a Spectator. And he pulled in and parked next to my Chevy Malibu or whatever I was driving, and he pulled it in there with his grandson, who, you know, was probably 8 or 10 years old when they popped out of it, and it was stunning. It was absolutely stunning. Yeah. I've always, but that would probably be number four. So
they're like little toolboxes.
I really appreciate that. Yes, absolutely. Oh, we've got another one. John asking, do you have a view on the Ford GT 2005 vintage as a collectible? Probably more so now that the movie's been out than prior. But
yeah, that's an interesting car. When it came out, it was, I'm here to tell you, the only car that I had an incident in on the street. I was able to pirouette very elegantly through an intersection when I accidentally floored it without going straight. So I learned a lesson very quickly. It's a remarkable car. I love it because even though it's a shameless retro design, it actually holds together. It's good looking. It is an honest interpretation. I think they will remain collectible. They didn't make enough of them. And importantly, there was nothing that has come after it that is of the same strain. So in other words, it's never been improved. The new Ford GT is a completely different animal. It bears no relation. So this thing sort of sits in its own little space. It sits isolated in its own decade. And it will always, by virtue of that, have a greater degree of collectability than if it were merely one of a progression of Ford GTs. So I think it's a pretty safe bet. And they're fun as hell.
And well, that goes back to the first part of the conversation, right? Is what's the point? And I think at the end of the day, that's the point, right? I think for cars especially, maybe this is a good place to wrap up. You know, you can buy a very inexpensive car, so to speak, that'll get you from A to B, or you can have some fun and delve into some of these amazing experiences. I guess that speaks to the heart of everybody that's on this call, because I don't think they would have spent an hour with us talking about this stuff unless they were also enthusiasts. So, Robert, we've spent an hour. You and I could, I think, talk for well into the night, but I think we should probably spare everybody that experience.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Andrew. Thank you for that, and David for bringing me into the conversation. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate it as well. And you know, a subtle plug for if this is a conversation that you really enjoyed, and we all life somewhat returns to normal, then maybe it makes sense to get in touch with David and talk about Car of the Year, where these types of experiences are had for an entire day in a very hands-on manner. So,
well, that'd be Robert, great. I'd look forward to meeting everyone. So,
as would I have them meet you. So, Robert, David, thank you very much. Thank you to all of our guests. David, I'll turn it back to you.
I just want to thank everybody for giving us an hour of their time. I think if anyone has an interest in Car of the Year and joining us in Napa or in Boca in November and December, it'll be a socially appropriate, socially distant event. Let Tom, Andrew, Greg, or any of the team know, and we'll send you that information. Maybe we can figure out something else, getting together in some way, shape, or form that's appropriate, you know, in the intervening months as this whole situation hopefully dissipates and we're allowed to get back to whatever the new normal is. So in the interim, thank you again. It's a pleasure, privilege, and an honor. It's always a treat to do anything with Robert and hear his opinions on a variety of things. In the meantime, please take care of yourselves and your loved ones, and hope everyone stays safe. God bless.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you all. Have a great night.